Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't
care.
I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, powered by FoxBet, NFL Week 14, Monday Night Football Edition. I'm your host, Todd Furman, joined, as always, by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only, Payne Insider.
Much needed weekend.
We had to work, buddy. We had to work in the college ranks and the National Football League for that 2-0.
Yeah. It was good games. Good games. I was a little put off early on about the 49ers game. A lot of third and longs. Fortunately, came through for us. I'll say one thing,
and not to cut you off. It is nice and refreshing from time to time in the National Football League when you bet a team that's competent, can go out there and actually execute. And even if you get down 13 points early, you don't feel it's a death knell, given a lot of the teams that we walk to the window with throughout the course of the regular season.
No, that's absolutely true. And Jimmy G took that next step. Kyle Shanahan was fantastic, as we expected. So good win for Bet the Board.
No doubt about it. And a game we'll break down in further detail in terms of what some of the biggest takeaways were, what they mean going forward, as we have a slightly different format today, but we'll get to that in a minute. Action-packed show. Dr. Chow will join us later, talk about some impactful injuries, arguably the biggest one for fantasy players out there, Mike Evans. Will he or won't he be back for the Tampa Bay Bucks? Well, we'll let the good doctor answer that question. And a game that we might run a two-minute drill on to close things out, Monday Night Football between the Philadelphia Eagles and the New York Giants. Not exactly brimming with intrigue, but of course, plenty still to be decided in the NFC East. But Payne, before we get there, instead of the good, the bad, and the ugly, you and I went back and forth yesterday and said, hey, look, there were three games that were going to have major impacts on the NFL playoff picture. It probably made the most sense to unpack those, figure out what the takeaways were, and what we had gleaned from those contests. So it feels like Western New York makes the most sense where we should start. A game where the Ravens did it with defense. They held the Bills to 3.1 yards per play. Lamar Jackson wasn't his phenomenal self, very workmanlike, efficient, made plays when he needed to, and Baltimore showed that they don't have to win a high-scoring track meet. This is still the same old Ravens. They can hit you in the mouth and win it with a physically imposing brand of defensive football.
I thought both defenses were great. And honestly, since that game ended, I've been wondering its long-term impact. You know, did Sean McDermott figure something out here, right? And I get it. Baltimore won. But the Bills defense, one that we have talked about for a long time now that's below average against the run, was fantastic. You know, and you just look at the total yards, held the Ravens to 257. You back out the blown coverage to Hayden Hurst. The other 58 Ravens offensive snaps, only 3.3 yards per play. And you mentioned how they kind of held Lamar Jackson in check. And it's amazing to say that when the guy throws up 30 fantasy points. He's just that electric. But 40 yards on 11 carries, 42% of his passing yards on the aforementioned blown coverage there. Only two explosive plays all game. So Buffalo did a fantastic job defensively. And, you know, I'm going to go back, I think, later today in a bit, look at the All-22 just to see what Buffalo actually did. Because there's no doubt in my mind that teams are going to be focusing on that film, trying to mimic it. And listen, you know, it's probably not going to have an impact against the Jets or Browns defenses in the next following weeks or whatever. But I think it could have a possible impact on some of the playoff games that Baltimore is going to face down the line.
Season low for Baltimore in that game, Payne. 247 yards. You mentioned the 61-yard big play to Hayden Hurst. They punted only 7 times. Coming into this game, they'd punted 24 times all season long. And you mentioned what Buffalo showed defensively. I'm not a defensive coordinator. I've never spent a ton of time in the film room outside of the fraternity when I had a couple beers telling my starting quarterback that he needed to work on some things, which he took with a grain of salt.
I could really see you doing this too.
Well, I mean, you're also talking to someone who did get fired from covering the football team because he was too critical of their performance for a good old Division III effort. When you lose 56-0, I don't have good things to say about you in the subsequent newspaper. Apparently that somehow negatively hurt recruiting when you're going out there trying to get 6-1 white kids to come play D3 football. But
I was just about to ask you if you were the play-by-play broadcaster crapping on them live, or if this was written work afterwards.
No, written work after. I was too busy drinking beers. I was one of like 37 students that would attend every football game I could, sitting up on the hill trying to storm the field when you beat your rivals when there's like six of you. It wasn't exactly an SEC experience. Let's not sugarcoat things in the least. But when I look at the way teams have had success, and again, I'm going to oversimplify. You're going to watch the film, so I'm curious to see what you take away. Would you not want to just take, and again, oversimplified, take Lamar Jackson out, force him to pitch the ball every single time, knowing that Ingram is more of a straight-ahead runner? I just key on Lamar, and every time he runs some sort of read option, make him feel the weight of your wrath coming down on him.
I would agree to a certain extent. Listen, the Ravens can beat you in a variety of ways. They have always been the most physical team on the field. You have to attempt to match that. And to your point, I'm a Mark Ingram guy, right? I am. And if you look at some of the metrics, and this is going to shock some people, he is actually the most efficient running back in the entire NFL this season. Now, certainly it helps having Lamar out there, right? Because he's probably the focal point. But in terms of like yards above replacement, he's number one. So I don't know if it's just that easy. He runs possessed. And I think the other part here that probably helped the Bills defense a little bit, and we alluded to it on Thursday's show, it's like, hey, it's windy as hell out there. It's going to be 18 mile per hour steady winds. It's going to be 40 mile an hour gusts. You're probably, you know, Hollywood Brown was dinged up with an ankle injury. So you're probably not going to have this deep attack. And Buffalo is going to be able to cheat down a little bit. And we talked about how good they were defending the tight end. And, I would say it was kind of a trick play there on the first touchdown to a tight end, but the second one was a blown coverage, so they weren't able to defend the tight end. If they do on that singular play, the Bills might have a different outcome here, but I don't know the best way to defend those guys. Certainly it's easy saying, hey, let's remove Lamar Jackson from this game, but he's been such an efficient passer, it's really tough to load the box and cheat that way as well, and that's really been the maturation of his game and this offense in general. I actually, when I watched this, I was disappointed by the Bills' offense. I thought they had a shot to be more physical at the line of scrimmage on offense, creating an advantage on the ground. They didn't really do that. And I thought Dable and Allen did a horrific job handling the pressure as well. And I get it, right? Pressure's tough to handle. It's tough to deal with. You still have a young quarterback. But you knew coming in that the Ravens were going to be this blitz-centric team, right? They rarely create pressure with just four guys. How did you not prepare better? I just thought that was difficult to watch, kind of how they handled the pressure. It just wasn't very good.
No, Buffalo's offense, we know, still their weakness. As much maturation as we've seen from Josh Allen, a long way to go. And of course, Buffalo, a massive game coming up on Sunday night as they'll go to Heinz Field to take on the Steelers, a game that we'll preview in great detail right here on the Bet the Board podcast on Thursday. From the defensive-minded slugfest in Western New York that went a long way in defining the AFC pecking order pain, one that's going to have long-lasting ramifications in the NFC took place simultaneously. And that was the San Francisco 49ers going down to the Big Easy, winning a shootout against the New Orleans Saints. You saw late-game heroics from George Kittle, who felt like a heavyweight fight with both defenses forced to adapt. Didn't do a great job throughout. Both quarterbacks, tremendous. 349 yards passing for Jimmy G, 349 yards passing for Drew Brees. Brees, a slight edge as far as touchdowns were concerned. But safe to say, this was Jimmy G's coming out party if he needed one, and the 49ers showed us an awful lot about their ability to win a number of different ways.
And I think that's the big point overall, right? I think we said about a month or so ago, if Jimmy G took the next step, 49ers are probably almost impossible to beat. And we felt like he had another gear in him, and he certainly found that in this game, right? You have to attack the Saints secondary. That's where they're still most vulnerable. And Kyle Shanahan, I think, proved again, and that was the biggest thing, why he is probably, arguably, the most brilliant offensive mind in this league right now. It's the imagination. It's the design of the play. It's how he makes everything almost look the same. The play calling, how he sets these things up, right? It's late in the game, it's the end around to kind of soften up the interior of the defense on the next run. He just has a great feel for the game. He has a great feel for offense. I think we even talked about this on Thursday. I know the Saints defense has improved, right? The parts are a lot better, but it's still Dennis Allen, right? It's still Dennis Allen's scheme. And Shanahan's faced this numerous times as the offensive coordinator in Atlanta. So you just go back to 2016 when Shanahan's the OC there, 83 points in those two games, all but seven of them were in the first three quarters. So 6 quarters of football back in 2016, Shanahan puts up 76 points against Allen's defense and obviously follows it up with 48 here, all of which were pretty needed. So I thought there was going to be a good game plan coming in. I knew Shanahan felt comfortable against the Saints scheme. I loved everything I saw, right? And it's a team that's been really about their defense. They had the most efficient passing defense that didn't show itself here, but they found another way to win. And I think that was pretty impressive. And I think that's kind of what indicates a very good football team. When you don't play your best, when you don't have one thing going, can you improvise? Can you make it work in another area? And I thought the 49ers did that pretty well.
Have to give the Niners credit. I mean, at the trade deadline, they go out and address one of their biggest glaring weaknesses, and you've seen that offense really take flight with the addition of Emmanuel Sanders because it's changed the role of Deebo Samuel. It's allowed the rookie to kind of get his feet wet in a secondary role, learn from a savvy veteran. Of course, Emmanuel Sanders throws the touchdown pass on the trick play as well. On the other side, Payne, how much different, if at all, does that game go if the Saints have Jared Cook out there? I mean, he was an absolute destructive force early. 2 touchdowns, 60-plus yards before he had to leave the game with a concussion.
Yeah, and to your point, you know, the 49ers came in. They were the number one pass defense in the NFL. They were fantastic covering tight ends. They still, after that game, have given up the least amount of yards to tight ends in the NFL. Certainly, there was an injury at safety, which impacted things. We saw Sherman kind of in and out of the lineup throughout the course of that game. Cooks was a big part of the offense, so I won't doubt that. The very first touchdown, though, it's third and long. You got to get off the field there. It's a blown coverage. The second one, I think we could probably debate if it was a touchdown or not.
I was actually going to ask you about that.
Johnson tossed and turned all night last night.
I have no idea. No idea how that's a touchdown. I actually watched it. Didn't have the audio on that game. Walked away and went, wait a second. What happened on that particular play? I still don't know to this point how that's a touchdown.
Yeah, I guess they called it a football move. And once he crossed the goal line with possession, after said football move, that was it. That was done. Didn't need to go to the ground with full possession. I guess that's the new ruling. It's, you know, geared towards offense, which is fun for the fans. But fantastic play. Probably wasn't even a penalty. But yeah, you know, that was kind of the interesting part of that about that game. The first two drives for the Saints, you're like, yeesh. Two third and longs completed. If the number one pass defense could get off the field on third and long in known passing situations, this probably looks a little bit different. And then the special teams got involved, which created a lot of short fields. So I thought after the initial burst, there were some adjustments made that bode pretty well. They did a good job stopping Kamara, but obviously having Cook out of there and Kamara not going, it became a one-man show for Michael Thomas, which again, apparently he's unstoppable, right? we're going to defend him with one guy. We're not going to defend with safety help. It's pretty ridiculous. And I guess at this point, it's got to be scheme, right? The scheme's just got to be so fantastic. They do different things to keep him open. But at some point, it's like, hey, I'm sticking two guys here. He's going to have to beat me with two. I'm going to make someone else beat me. That's just, it's frustrating to watch, but a great game. The Saints have to figure it out with whatever's going on with Kamara, because that explosive element, not having him really involved in the offense or being a big part of it, is really hindering things. And it's wild because you look and it's like, hey, the ground game didn't really get going. But you just look again on the season. Offensive line's been fantastic. Number one in adjusted line yards. I went back this morning and I was like, geesh, maybe I'm missing something here. Nope. Prior to this game, even the trending metrics, the Saints were number one in terms of rushing success rate. So it's not looking like what the metrics are saying. So for, I think, the Saints to really compete and to really be a Super Bowl contender, we need to get Kamara's best, and that's not happening right now.
Last thing on this particular game, were there any concerns you have for the 49ers defense going forward and what that might mean within the context of the NFC?
I don't want to take too much from it. You know, very physical game against Baltimore. They got beat up. You don't travel back home, which I think was nice. Sherman was dealing with some injuries. You had an injured member in the secondary. I think the linebacker core probably is a little bit questionable, with Quan Alexander obviously out for the season. Ford comes back, re-injures the hamstring immediately. So there are some question marks there, right? You got to get guys healthy. And I think that's probably the big thing here. Can you get guys healthy? If they handle their business, you could have a potential bye week, which would loom large with a couple of these guys banged up on the defensive side.
Oh, it'll make that Week 17 game in the Pacific Northwest against Seattle potentially one of the biggest in the National Football League, not just in terms of who wins that division, but knowing that you could go from the number one seed in the NFC and slip all the way down to the five spots. So circle that game on your calendars the final week of the regular season, barring that both those teams are able to hold serve up until that point. As far as the late afternoon pain, the signature game was supposed to be the Patriots and Chiefs, and I don't think it disappointed unless you had a lot of fantasy need from that particular contest, especially on the New England side. Yet you have to wonder if it's time to panic, and we don't do that around here, but New England, not exactly synonymous with losing back-to-back games in the month of December. There were a number of brutal calls, and typically those seem to go the Patriots' way. You can get me on a rant as far as the challenge system and how that's flawed, that if you win challenges, somehow you don't have one in the bank for the Jacoby Myers play. But in terms of what took place on the football field, New England gets the early score. Kansas City answers back. But over the last 25 minutes or so, the Chiefs are completely stymied. What were the major takeaways from either side in this football game in terms of what we saw unfold in Foxborough?
I think there's a lot, right? If you're the Patriots, I honestly think the time to panic was 6 weeks ago. And we were, I don't want to pound the table, but we were right there, right? We've been kind of talking about the phony win against Cleveland. And I don't know what they've done to prove any different. You know, yesterday's performance, I think, was just the confirmation that we kind of knew, right? And again, we've been really the only ones, and you can rewind the tape on the AFC Preview podcast, that had real questions about the Patriots offense coming in. And it's tough to say this about a Brady Belichick team with 10 wins, but I don't know if they're a serious contender right now, right? And even with they're probably going to end with 12 wins at least. I still don't know if that's going to change my mind, right? Because New England's been handled pretty easily in their last three games against AFC teams that will be in the playoffs. So again, there might be this rebound here in the coming weeks against the Bengals and Dolphins. I don't know if that's going to tell us anything. And yeah,
go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Why I've been concerned, and why I've kind of made mention of this throughout the last couple months, it doesn't seem like you can fix what ails everything right now offensively. You don't have the dominant offensive line with James Devlin at fullback leading the way for this like ground and pound attack, right? That was the schematic change late last season that led him to another Super Bowl. They can't do that right now. The receiving core to me isn't good enough either, right? So you can't become this pass-happy offense. This is a personnel issue. Because there's no way on earth, if you think about this logically, as smart, as savvy, with the amount of time and preparation that Brady and Belichick put in, that this offense wouldn't have been fixed by now, right, if it wasn't a personnel issue. And to your point, you look at this game, 278 total yards at home. After the script wore off, that was 83 on the first drive. You had the trick play towards the end of the game that was responsible for another 35 yards. So aside from one drive and one trick play, what was this offense? They were done all game long. And I know we can sit here and say, hey, they got screwed on the N'Keal Henry touchdown. Sure. Hey, they got screwed on an early stoppage of the fumble. Sure. Hey. What happens if that fumble doesn't happen? That's like the most ridiculous defensive play I've seen in a long time, with McCourty like flying over, trying to punch it out with his right as he's coming down with the left. He strips it, right? You get the blocked punt again.
Yep.
What is this team without these things? I mean, they two huge plays there, a trick play. Like, that's what they had to resort to. Think about this in the first half, and it was pretty telling to me. I understand they didn't believe at that time they could beat the Chiefs kicking field goals. But you're down 10. It felt extremely desperate not cutting it back to a one-score game early and going for it on 4th and 7. That was the first time like in years I can remember being like, Jesus Christ, these guys are like desperate as hell right now. They kind of know that, I don't know if they're going to win this. Like, they're going for it on 4th and 7, down 10 in the first half. That was shocking to me.
How far can their defense take them?
Well, that's the big question, right? Because in the first half, they got decimated. And that was the one thing that we talked about again last week. It's like, how good is the defense, right? Everyone's talking about historically good. haven't played anybody. Anytime they have, they haven't been elite. So that's the big question here. And when you look at the landscape of the AFC and the offenses you're going to face, they're pretty elite offenses, whether it's KC potentially, whether it's Baltimore, whether it's Houston, if they get going and Bill O'Brien gets his head out of his ass, right? So some very tough offenses that they're going to potentially...
How dare you not throw the Tennessee Titans into the mix there?
Hey, most explosive running and passing offense since Ryan Tannehill's taken over. So maybe you do throw them in that mix as well as they've played offensively.
As far as the other side, I mean, we had some concerns about Kansas City coming into the game. I think you were banging the drum earlier than anybody out there talking about how underrated this team was defensively with some of its secondary play. We knew that they could be beat up a little bit on the run, but not everybody in the league has that ability, or more importantly, the patience to put together that 12 to 15 play march and run the ball for 4 or 5 yards a pop. From an offensive standpoint, yes, Kansas City goes out there and wins, but yet again, Payne, they can't run the football consistently. LeSean McCoy appears to be their best option. 11 carries, sub 40-yard performance. Can Kansas City win games and get to the Super Bowl down in your neck of the woods if they're as one-dimensional as they become, even with a quarterback as good as Mahomes?
I was hoping for the Darwin Thompson just surge here. He was going to take over the running back duties. Looks a little different than it did in preseason. He's pitter-pattering around. He's not hitting holes. Took his eye off the ball in the pass game. Everything that I've been hearing, and I do, we obviously mentioned this a few weeks ago, so I do think it's an issue, right? Them not being balanced. You can only rely on Patty Mahomes for so long, especially potentially as the weather gets a little more difficult in the next couple weeks. But from what I'm hearing, they believe Damian Williams will be back. They have been keeping LeSean McCoy on a pitch count, even not, you know, dressing him for a game because he was dealing with a couple nagging injuries that he could have played through, but they know they need him for the big games coming down the stretch. So if that's the case, Damian Williams does return and LeSean McCoy returns to form because they've been kind of keeping him on a pitch count throughout the season. That could be big. And we talked about it a little bit on Thursday, that Mecole Hardman's kind of becoming that X factor where you can't completely double the big tight end there, Travis Kelce. You can't double Tariq Hill because Mecole Hardman's that X factor that will kind of burn you occasionally if you're deciding to defend him one-on-one. And the Patriots took a different approach defensively as well. They didn't put Gilmore on Kelce and double Tyreek all the time. They changed the formula up a little bit. Now, in the second half of that game, to your point, Bill Belichick made some adjustments, kind of shut some things down in a major way there. And that was kind of the one question mark we have had. You look schematically, the Patriots play the most man-to-man defense in the NFL. They do it about 70% of the time. And Patty Mahomes in the offense, this season at least, hasn't been as good against man. So a lot of these teams go out there and say, hey, we're going to play zone. We're going to try to keep everything in front. We're not going to allow Tyreek or Mecole to beat us on one play. And you open up all these zones within the offense where Patty Mahomes can execute and get the ball out quickly. It's actually been man defense that's given him the most trouble. So that was something that Bill knew coming into the game, made the adjustment at the half, and it was certainly a little bit different of a vibe from that regard. So you need that ground game. You really do. So whether it's Damian Williams, whether it's LeSean McCoy, you need to at least be somewhat balanced come playoff time.
Going to be interesting. If you look at Kansas City, it doesn't appear, unless they get some help, that they're going to have a bye through that first round. We know they clinched the AFC West, but we've seen those wild card teams struggle, and sometimes that extra game can take its toll, especially if they're on a crash course, potentially, to take on Baltimore in an AFC championship game. So a lot of intrigue all over both conferences as we see some of the
on paper, that's probably not an overly good matchup.
No, I was going to say, and plus you have the revenge angle, too, for Baltimore. Yes. For a game that got away from him. So
that's so curious. Weird to me, because that game honestly wasn't as close. Like, I'm thinking,
no, you know, it wasn't
thinking
as close.
We're thinking out loud. It's like, well, the Chiefs have a tough time running the ball, and they like to chuck it, and that's kind of the strength of the Baltimore defense, and Baltimore can run it, and that's really the weakness of the Chiefs defense. You're like, matchup is great. First outing wasn't even close. That final score, not even close to indicative of what actually happened. So, I don't know. I'm thinking about that right now. That's interesting.
Well, but there is one thing to factor into that. When you look at the way the Ravens defense struggled, no Marcus Peters. Yep. And no Jimmy Smith out there in the secondary.
Yep, exactly.
So a little bit of a different animal there. But three of the biggest games that we've seen arguably in the same week all season long. Curious to see what this means for the six teams that were involved going forward, all with playoff aspirations. And I really don't see a scenario where any of them miss the postseason. I guess Buffalo's hold the most tenuous, knowing that they have a couple teams breathing down their neck in the AFC. Moving forward, Payne, we look at some of the look-ahead lines. Not massive adjustments in the market by any stretch of the imagination, but we did see a little bit of movement. A look-ahead line in an NFC North showdown between the Packers and Bears had Green Bay right around a touchdown favorite. Right now at FoxBet, you're looking at Green Bay, only a 4.5-point chalk. The Bears, of course, a relatively dominant performance on Thursday against the Dallas Cowboys. Green Bay workmanlike, for a lack of a better term, in dispatching of the Redskins despite being double-digit favorites.
You're being kind. I mean, Green Bay is as fraudulent as it gets, man. This is
don't tell Aaron Rodgers that he believes they're a Super Bowl contender.
This is not an elite football team. The record is certainly disguising things, and the market's caught up to them, right? Now, at the same time, this becomes really interesting because everyone's in love with the Chicago Bears all of a sudden. And you can see why this line has come down. It'll be interesting to see how much further this potentially comes down, because where you really need to beat the Packers is running at them. Certainly Chicago's improved with some of the effort in the ground game, but are they going to be able to attack that weakness of the Packers defense? Or are you just going to have Trubisky chucking it and ducking it? And again, the box scores look good. It's not necessarily looking that way metrically, and I think there's a couple tough games down the stretch to see if Mitch is going to be the guy next year, or if things start to trend back how they were at the beginning of the season. This is a huge stretch for Mitchell Trubisky, but I'm intrigued to see how low this line gets.
Well, three games for Mitchell that are going to go a long way defining exactly how much money he's going to be entitled to. When you look at two games in the division, Green Bay and Minnesota, bookending a trip to Kansas City to take on the Chiefs. So be fascinating to see how things go. But don't tell Bear fans that, though. They believe they have an inside track to getting into the NFC playoff picture as a viable wild card team. As far as the AFC, Payne, one of the bigger games that we're going to see in the AFC South all season, and these two teams will meet not once, but twice over the final 3 weeks of the regular season. The look-ahead line had the Tennessee Titans, a 2.5-point home favorite as they played host to the Houston Texans. Now you look at the price on FoxBet, and the Titans are out to -3, -$1.20. The Titans, 42-21, dominant effort against Oakland, continuing their momentum. You mentioned some of Ryan Tannehill's metrics. Meanwhile, Houston, an egg that I'm not going to say we saw coming, because I openly admit that I did not have a sent on the Denver Broncos and what I thought would be a letdown for Houston, but clearly the Texans have to bounce back from that debacle that was their lack of effort against the Broncos yesterday.
Monday morning, gotta love it. I don't think we're gonna see 3.5 now. Some interesting matchups. Obviously, both secondaries are extremely vulnerable.
That escalated quickly.
Yeah. So, not even waiting for the 3.5. So Houston's getting hit as we speak, and you know, figure out if that becomes a strong play. Man, that's frustrating. All right. So, both secondaries are going to have some problems here, I would think. Tennessee secondary, one of the most, I would say, fraudulent secondaries. It's been a below average unit despite facing a really, really poor schedule of passing attacks. You would think Watson and company rebound. Tennessee, are they going to be able to get the ground game going? That's basically the best element of the Houston defense, stopping the run. But Tannehill should have some success through the air there as well. To me, and I could be completely wrong here. Now, listen, I'm not a Bill O'Brien fan. There's obviously familiarity here with the two coaching staffs, both coming from New England. But last week is just so Bill O'Brien, right? Like, knocks off his former employer, and there's some rift going on there. And, you know, he was fined for trying to poach some defensive staff members from the Patriots. So I know everyone tried blowing it out of proportion. Like, Belichick big leagued him after the game with the handshake. One, that's kind of just Belichick's vibe. He does that every week. But two, there's some bad blood there because O'Brien tried poaching some guys from his staff and the league stepped in and said, hey, there's an issue here. They even fined the guy. So Now you have this look-ahead spot right to Tennessee. Denver became really unimportant, so I don't want to take too much from that game. And it looks like the market agrees with me here.
Well, we figured there would be a correction. I'd hope the correction came at 3.5, but alas, this is the world we live in as far as betting markets before 8 a.m. Pacific on a Monday morning out here on the lovely West Coast. And Payne, this look-ahead line, a game that we'll talk about in great detail, has seen the biggest movement, especially when you talk about going through a key number here. The Dallas Cowboys, look-ahead number against the Rams, had them listed as a 3.5-point favorite. Last night, before we saw the Rams play, the Cowboys were a 3-point favorite. Lo and behold, I'm looking at the screen right now, and this number all the way down to 2.5, as the resurgent Rams will try and keep their playoff hopes alive and maybe put another nail in the Cowboys' coffin. But when has the market moved too much in terms of public perception around these two teams?
Well, listen, there's not much home field advantage here. We've kind of discussed that ad nauseum over the years, especially since they built Jerry's World, right? Everyone loves going to play there. And the Rams are a little bit of a different team. This probably is a game where the Rams defense, right now, this Dallas offense hasn't shown signs. And I know you can look at the scoreboard last week and be like, hey, you know, we're a missed chip shot field goal away from scoring 27. But it just doesn't look
garbage
right.
Garbage time.
Right.
Garbage time offense.
Yeah, and even the opening drive, everyone's like raving about it. It's like, oh my God, 17 plays, 75 yards. It required a 3rd and 11. It required a 3rd and 9. Right? It wasn't this like, we're just super efficient moving the ball down the field. This Rams defense is trending in the right direction, and the numbers are pretty gaudy since Jalen Ramsey returned. I know we talked about that last Thursday on the podcast, and they really held Seattle's offense in check last night. So I don't know if that's going to change here. It's a team that can get pressure on the quarterback as well. Offensively, we've thought that the market was devaluing them a little bit based on some of their metrics, right? They came into Sunday Night Football 20th in efficiency. Well, they have all the receivers back now. Finally, Higby is kind of forming into the tight end we thought he could be. Everett's now out with injury, so it's all Higby, and I think that's a positive. Ground game is going a little bit. Gurley looks like he's got that extra burst they talked about holding him back this season for this run. It seems like McVay's hit that perfectly because he does seem to have that extra burst that he had last season. So now the ground game's going a little bit. Blythe, they've moved to center. They've started two rookies at right guard and right tackle, so they've made some changes offensively along the line. That's helped as well. So I get the move. It'll be interesting to see what the final position is here. But 3.5 was just probably too much of a number with how the Rams are playing right now. And it's not like this game is meaningless for them. There's everything in the world here at play. So I think just look when you look at these two teams, right, how they're trending, how they're playing, both have everything to play for, the coaching staffs. It does make some sense. 3.5 was never going to be the number here.
Two ships passing in the night, headed in very different trajectories, although what's interesting for the Cowboys, even with a loss against the Rams, they would still very much be in the thick of the playoff picture, knowing that they get a road game against Philadelphia coming up in Week 16. That's really it as far as some of the numbers that have moved a decent amount, Payne.
There hasn't been much movement.
No, you think that the market ultimately is going to stabilize this time of the year. You figure it will. But you know what can impact market movement and some of the numbers for teams on the outside of the playoff picture looking in? It's the injury report.
Are you injured or are you hurt?
When injuries occur in the NFL, there's only one man to turn to.
If you're hurt, you can still play. If you're injured, you can't.
Let's check in with 17-year NFL team doctor turned medical analyst, Dr. David Chow.
So are you hurt or are you injured?
This is Chow's Corner.
He joins us every Monday here on the Bet the Board podcast. You can follow Dr. David Chow at ProFootballDoc on Twitter, the single greatest source of information injury-wise for your gambling, for your fantasy, and everything else related to the biggest matchups on Sunday football. And Dr. Chow, as we get ever so close to the fantasy football playoffs, I know some leagues have already started there. There happened to be a massive injury down there in Tampa, and Jameis Winston throws for more than 400 yards, but Mike Evans wasn't able to be out there for a full four quarters.
Yeah, you know, normally it's hard to judge hamstring issues and injuries in terms of severity. Does the guy pull up right before he hurts it, or does he pull up, you know, a step too late kind of deal. But this one with a high muscle hamstring had the feel of something pretty significant where, in all likelihood, he's probably not back this season.
Oof. That is not good news for fantasy owners unless you have Goodwin, I would think. Dr. Chow, I want to ask you a question here, and it's about a player that, you know, didn't actually suffer a substantial injury this week, but in my mind, he is involved in the largest injury news that we have right now, and that's Baker Mayfield. I just want to get your thoughts on this. As a former, you know, 17-year NFL team doctor, what were your very first thoughts when you heard Baker Mayfield call out the Cleveland Browns medical staff for not handling the OBJ injury properly in his mind? And if you were a Cleveland team doctor right this second, how would you kind of handle that situation?
Well, first of all, you know, when he first said it, I thought it was pretty strange that he didn't stay in his lane, so to speak, but that's Baker Mayfield. I guess that's his right. But my first real thought is, no one can force a player to have surgery, or no one can force a player not to have surgery. We know second opinions are a right in the CBA, and look at Kelechi Osemele, look at other situations. A player or patient is in charge of his or her own destiny, period, end of discussion. So I tweeted out, you know, who's he really critical of? I mean, let's compare this to the DeSean Jackson situation in Philadelphia, where he didn't have the core muscle surgery for a while, and now it cost him the season. And there's lots of work where DeSean Jackson kind of made that decision. So I thought it was interesting, who was he really criticizing? In the end, I think it was probably just overall frustration and a general feeling of it's like after you lose a game, you're not necessarily blaming anyone, but things didn't work out the way you wanted them to work out. And I think that's probably what he actually meant. But I don't know that Baker chose his words as precisely as a quarterback leader typically does. He's a fiery guy, and he proved it again. At least he came out and kind of recanted a little bit.
The
final thought is, no matter what happens, the medical staff can never speak up because of HIPAA. I mean, look at all the examples around the league where there's been some potential discourse. Even this last week, Frank Reich expressing disappointment on Eric Ebron and or Colts, you know, the way it was or wasn't handled. Andrew Luck, even with the Colts. Heck, DeSean Jackson, Philly fans have been on their medical staff for a long time. The Jets with Assembly, and then Luke Falk with the grievance. And then, of course, in Washington with Trent Williams. And in that case, you know, Washington said, look, let's review all the medical records. Let's get an independent review. And Trent Williams said no. So there's been more and more discourse as time has gone on.
Let me ask you one more thing, Dr. Chow. Say you're the team, the lead physician for the Browns. Would you speak with Baker directly about this, or how does that relationship look moving forward with the two of you if you were the lead physician for the Cleveland Browns?
I think it depends on your relationship with it. I mean, with who it was. I think typically I would, you know, just asking me typically, I have a pretty open door policy, is I would sit him down and say, hey, can we chat about that? What are your thoughts? And let's have an open dialogue, you know, and I don't have anything to hide with it. But it comes with the territory. I talked about this before on my podcast. Everyone in San Diego thought I had mistreated Sean Merriman when I'm the one who told him he needed the surgery after, you know, he hurt his knee pretty badly. And Sean knew that. And then finally, when he didn't have surgery and the season rolled around and he still wasn't right, he was upset at the team for not giving him a new contract, not at me. So he flew around with some opinions. I was the guy talking to Sean the whole time about where to go for other opinions to make sure he was good. He actually came to my charity event a few days after that and announced he was still going to try and play, but only played one game before he had the surgery. Meanwhile, everyone around town was like, oh, somehow I messed him up because we didn't do surgery on him earlier, you know? But I still couldn't really talk about it because of HIPAA law. So what happens on the inside is not necessarily what happens on the outside. I don't know what's happening in Cleveland. I don't know what the relationship is with Baker. It may be very good, and the apology is good enough, or they may have further conversations. It's hard to say.
Speaking of Merriman, a very, very tough guy, I want to kind of transition to another guy who's been battling some injuries here, Josh Jacobs, the Raiders running back. We know he's been playing through that shoulder injury since, I think, against the Green Bay Packers, where they had to shoot him up a little bit. But reports surfaced this week that Jacobs had a cracked shoulder blade. He was a late scratch Sunday against the Titans in what felt like an elimination game. If Jacobs isn't playing in a game that's that important, do we believe his season's done now at this point with Oakland all but out?
Well, you guys have known me long enough. I don't try and BS you or your listeners. There's some missing pieces to the puzzle on Josh Jacobs that I haven't been able to figure out yet. And here's sort of the medical detective work. He hurt it in week 7, and let's assume, and they're saying it was a shoulder blade or scapula fracture in week 7. That's a very painful injury, usually no surgery. And, you know, look at how tough Josh Jacobs is, and he played through that week 7 injury and, you know, was limited in practice but hadn't missed any time. And that typically is about 4 to 6 weeks, certainly 2 weeks of a lot of pain, but 4 to 6 weeks and you're usually pretty good. Well, this is now the 7th week. And so this last week, for the first time, he had 2 DNPs. So I have to worry that did something else happen? Did something worse happen? Or what part of the story are we missing here? I think it's too simplistic to say this was a week 7 scapula fracture and now all of a sudden he missed for the first time.
Very interesting. And with Oakland 2 games back of Tennessee and they don't have the tiebreaker with 3 to play, it'll be interesting to see if Jacobs is there down the stretch. Another one I want to ask you about is Mark Andrews. He's Lamar Jackson's favorite target. You look at Andrews, he leads the Ravens in receiving touchdowns, has 40% more receptions than any receiver on the Baltimore's roster. How serious is the knee injury for Mark Andrews, and what's the timeline there?
Well, it's a knee/leg, and I don't think it's that serious. By video, and had a couple of shots at it, but none of the video that I saw like a, oh my gosh, this is an ACL or something very significant or season ending. So I'm hoping it's more in the contusion variety and that he will be able to come back and play.
Interesting. And the last one I want to ask you about before I pass the baton back to Todd, Dwayne Haskins. It seems like fans were outraged he finished that game, but what does it look like for the lower leg injury of Dwayne Haskins?
Yeah, I don't know why fans were outraged about it. I mean, he's got a high ankle sprain by video. He got rolled up on both ankles, but then right high ankle sprain. And yes, Daniel Jones is missing tonight's game with a high ankle sprain. But let's look at the example of Daniel Jones. He hurt it in the 2nd quarter and finished the game, and they're deciding to sit him this week. Haskins finished his game essentially with a similar injury. Let's look at week 1. You know, Patrick Mahomes had a probably worse high ankle sprain than either of these two, and he finished the game. The difference is Patrick Mahomes, with his skill set, is able to handle an injury much better in the sense of 85% of Patrick Mahomes is pretty darn good still. I think the Giants are smart to sit Daniel Jones because as a rookie, especially this late in the season, you're really drinking from the fire hose, so to speak. And now you have to think about your ankle and, you know, modify your game and, you know, you're iffy as it is and you're going to hurt something else. It's smart to sit him down and take a step back. I'm not sure what Washington will do with Haskins there, but what's happened there is not unprecedented. And this is why I always say injuries, as you evaluate them and what happens, has to be an individual situation. You can't say high ankle sprain equals X, either in terms of week, in terms of production, or in terms of the whole process of how decision-making is made.
Two final injuries, Dr. Chow, that Payne mentioned, both pretty impactful should they prove to be serious as far as the NFC West pecking order is concerned. We saw Rashad Penny go down early with a lower body injury in last night's loss against the Rams. And also earlier in the day, San Francisco 49ers starting center Weston Richburg was clutching at the back of his leg. I know he was ultimately carted off the Superdome turf, but what can we make of those two injuries, and should we be able to expect those players back as they both would play a significant hand in ultimately who maybe gets the number 1 seed in the NFC, let alone win the division?
Well, I think you can expect both those players back, but in 2020, not for this season, unfortunately. Rashad Penny looked in real time, and I tweeted on the .com website about an ACL tear. And after the game, Pete Carroll said a significant ACL sprain. And that's just Pete trying to stay glass half full.
a grade 3 sprain is a tear, so he sits with a significant sprain. So unfortunately, it feels like Penny's season is done with an ACL tear. And the thing to watch is, given the timeline, the December injury, that makes it tight for a 2020 week one full return. And Weston Richburg, I think, has a pretty significant knee injury. He was kind of in a pile a little bit and caught with his own right guard. But there's some worry of significant even tendon damage there, maybe even a patella tendon rupture of some sort there. And he's likely headed for surgery in his season.
He is the single best voice of reason. And when it comes to injury news in the National Football League, Dr. David Chow joins us every Monday here on the Bet the Board podcast. Encourage you, if you're not already doing so, to be sure to follow him on Twitter at ProFootballDoc. Check out his podcast as he delves a little bit deeper sometimes than we have time for right here on the Bet the Board podcast. Dr. Chow, can't thank you enough for your time as always. Even with bad news for a lot of the fantasy owners, we always appreciate having you on.
Thanks, guys.
I guess, Payne, from all the injuries we hit on with Dr. Chow, the most impactful for fantasy players, hands down, has to be Mike Evans, although it won't really have any impact in terms of the overall playoff picture in the NFC.
Mike Evans is a big one. Obviously, Josh Jacobs is too. I'm sure he was RB1 for a lot of fantasy teams. So those are certainly the two big ones. Was really intrigued to get his viewpoints on Baker Mayfield's comments. That whole landscape kind of intrigues me there.
Yeah, I thought it was fascinating when you talk about that, knowing how OBJ has expressed his displeasure with the situation. Jay Glazer, of course, was the first one to report that OBJ was going to be dealt from New York. I have to imagine if you read the tea leaves, and it doesn't take a visionary to see it, that OBJ probably won't be in that Browns receiving corps to start the 2020 season.
You didn't like him yesterday, not participating in some of the huddles, just kind of lined up out wide, talking to the DBs.
I didn't quite think that was a good look. And you know what's crazy about all that? And I don't want to go too far off because I want to wrap up the show with a quick preview of tonight's game. The fact that, you know, you're there in Cleveland with one of your longtime buddies from college, Jarvis Landry, that still a massive disconnect. And it leads me to believe that the Giants, as criticized as they were for dealing him, made the right move being rid of OBJ despite his on-field talent. Everything else that comes along with it just clearly isn't worth it at this point.
And honestly, the performance isn't up to a point right now where you're going to deal with that. But to your point, I think, you know, Jarvis Landry is going to be a guy that could kind of rein him in a little bit. Doesn't seem to be the case. And you just wonder if that was a last-ditch effort from Baker Mayfield after the game to kind of put his arm around OBJ, console him. And it led to him talking out of his ass, but potentially that was a last-ditch effort to save that relationship, kind of going to bat for his guy.
Pretty crazy how Cleveland had these delusions of grandeur. They aren't going to be realized. We'll see Freddie Kitchens, Baker Mayfield, and who else will be back next year with the Browns. But from OBJ's new team to his old team, who go on the road to Lincoln Financial Field as pretty sizable underdogs. Right now at Fox Bet Philadelphia, a 9-point favorite, total in the game 44.5. And as always, our big game breakdown brought to you courtesy of Fox Bet, where the biggest name in sports is now the biggest name in sports betting. Download the Fox Bet app, absolutely anywhere. Real-time odds updates right to your mobile phone. Real money wagering available in New York and New Jersey and Pennsylvania. Fox Bet, make the call. Download the app today. A familiar face returns under center tonight for the Giants. Payne, it's Eli Manning. And when you look at Eli, he hasn't beaten the Philadelphia Eagles since 2016. He hasn't won at Lincoln Financial since 2013. I don't think our listeners are worried about if Eli Manning is going to win this game outright. Probably more what he needs to do if the Giants are going to be able to cover against Philadelphia.
What a shit sandwich they gave us tonight. Like, holy cow. It's Eli.
I might watch a couple of series. I might watch a couple of series and try and start to get my bull work under control.
There you go. Eli against a slumping Eagles team with some weather in the forecast. Always fun. You know, I'm intrigued to see what kind of Eli we get tonight, right? Do we get the guy that's trying to, like, go out there and protect the football and not make mistakes? Or does Eli just say, fuck it? You know, we're underdogs. This can be the last start of my career. I'm going to go out there and chuck it around, take some chances, have some fun. So I think with that, there could be a little variance, right? And I know you alluded to at the top that the Giants haven't performed overly well in the win-loss column. But I think Eli's had some success, at least recently, against this defense. And if you look last season, Eli completes 63% of his passes in the two games against Philly, 578 passing yards. And it initially looked like he was going to have all his weapons tonight. But Evan Engram, I guess, was scratched Saturday afternoon. Shermer said he thought he would play on Friday. So that is a big loss, expecting Evan Engram to go, but now he's out. Anyways, I went back, looked at both meetings last season. The first go-around, the Giants outgained Philly by 0.8 yards per play. The second meeting, New York goes into Philly, puts up over 400 yards of offense, outgains the Eagles by 1.4 yards per play. So I can tell you, when this game reached 10, we did see a buy on Eli in the Giants. It was a value bet. Nothing huge. To quickly go over this, because I don't know how much time we want to spend. I think if you're looking at the Giants
offense, the answer is not a lot, Payne. The answer is not a lot.
Yeah, like as I'm talking about this, I'm like, this isn't very motivating to speak about. You know, and there's two things that are somewhat relevant here, right? And the first is Eli against the Eagles defensive line and the pressure that can be created there, right? Eli's always hated pressure. We kind of made that joke years ago. He looks like a fish out of water when pressure's on and he kind of drops to the ground and kind of squiggles around there. We've seen him duck out of throws over the years, right? A lot of his mistakes come when guys are barreling down on him. This season, and it's only a two-game sample size, but there's a reason he was replaced, and it's because Eli has a passer rating of 15 when he's under pressure. And the Eagles are top 10 in pressure rate, and I'm not sure how Mike Remmers at right tackle is going to be able to handle Brandon Graham tonight. And if you kind of read the tea leaves there, Brandon Graham's hoping for 10 sacks. He's at 7.5 now. There's a couple bonuses and escalators that he would like to achieve. So
he might get 13 tonight.
That's going to be one of the matchups to watch, right? Pressure on Eli, specifically Brandon Graham against Mike Remmers at right tackle. I guess the second question would be Saquon against the Eagles run defense. It's probably going to be tough sledding, right? The Giants O-line doesn't create a lot of space for Saquon in the ground game. You look, they're 26th in adjusted line yards. On the other side, you have an Eagles defense that's 8th in defensive rush efficiency, 7th in rushing success rate. You would think the goal for Philly is to shut down Saquon, make Eli beat them. Internally, I can tell you that Jim Schwartz and the Eagles defense were embarrassed last week at Miami. They've said as much. The unit thought they were turning a corner. They were becoming the strength of the team. Last week's performance kind of came out of nowhere. I would expect them to rebound a little bit here on that side of the ball. Eagles offensively, you want to touch on that just lightly, quickly?
Go for it. I'll give you how long you need. You want 42 seconds?
You know, that probably works. You would hope there were some matchup advantages here. You would, right? Just kind of glossing over this broadly, you're like, Giants defense, 27th in overall efficiency. This is probably going to be fairly easy sledding. But I think you're going to have some intensity there from the Giants defense. It's a division game. They'd love nothing more than to boot Philadelphia from the playoffs. They've been decent in some areas, right? Metrically speaking, you would think the Eagles have a tougher time running. The Giants are shockingly 4th. And rushing success rate despite facing a top 10 schedule of run offenses. So who knows how much balance will be there. You look at where the Eagles like to attack with Carson Wentz and as a franchise in general, right? It's usually thrown to the tight ends and running backs. Ertz is really banged up. Probably had his worst game of the season at Miami, a team that can't cover tight ends because he's not 100%. So that's interesting. But you look at the Giants, they've allowed a league-low 38 receptions to tight ends. They're one of two defenses that hasn't allowed a receiving touchdown to a running back. So those matchups are pretty interesting because that is like how Philadelphia likes to attack. That said, the Giants defense does lose its mind at times, right? And they give up a lot of explosive plays, 28th and explosive pass defense in the bottom half of the league and explosive run defense. So the Giants have to be a little more disciplined tonight. But it is an intriguing matchup, and the under is very real because some of those matchups for the Giants defense, and then I think Philadelphia's defense rebounds a little bit here. And then you have the weather. You're looking right now, calling for about a 68% chance of rain, about a 15-mile-per-hour steady wind, and the gusts are actually approaching about 40 miles per hour. So that's why we've seen this come off the key of 47, down through another key of 45. You're now at about 44.5. I know there were some guys who missed the initial number. They were looking first half under at 23. Obviously, that is not a consensus number right now, but if you're, you know, a pro bettor, you take this somewhat seriously and you have multiple outs, there are a few straggling 23s out there. So, again, I haven't touched this game, don't have a penny on it, but at 10, there is a value bet on the dog. At 23, there is a value bet in the first half under.
It's a hell of a lot more than 47 seconds, Pete.
There we go.
I'm going to give you a stopwatch.
Getting out of Dodge.
Hey, one final thing, and you look at the NFC East futility, and I found this stat hysterical and appalling all at the same time. The entire division, since November 17th, has one win. That win was Washington's upset victory against the Carolina Panthers. Little to say, it hasn't exactly been a banner three-plus weeks for the four teams hailing in the worst division in the National Football League.
It's been ugly. And you think about some of these teams coming into the season, we're certainly down on Washington. And for our Bet the Board faithful, on top of the 2-0 weekend, a good one there with the Redskins losing that win total under 6.5 officially in the bag. But I thought Dallas was going to be better than folks anticipated. We really liked Philadelphia, right? The DeSean Jackson signing, that was going to put them over the top. Philadelphia winning that division was like one of the sharpest bettors, best futures of the entire season. So I'm shocked at a team that's 5-7. But again, DeSean Jackson goes down. You don't have that vertical threat. There's been a lot of injuries. Doug Peterson, there's some question marks about him. And I don't want to go too far into this and not, you know, can't divulge too much. But there's some question marks now within the organization about how good Doug Peterson is, right? Frank Reich left. John DeFilippo left. Offense hasn't quite looked the same once those guys have departed.
Got to surround yourself with smart people. Doesn't matter from the National Football League or business. That's how things get done, especially in an efficient and effective manner. You can follow Payne effectively and efficiently on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there, and you can follow the Bet the Board podcast as well. Also, encourage you to follow Dr. David Chow at Pro Football Doc. Payne, any final words of wisdom, parting shots before we reconvene on Thursday this week with no Wednesday college football podcast on the horizon?
No. We'll check back on Thursday. What is it, week 15? Keep the little NFL run going and end with a bang.
Getting late early in the National Football League. For all of us here at Bet the Board Podcast, best of luck with any wagers you make on Monday Night Football. We'll be right back here with you on Thursday, previewing all the marquee matchups of week 15. And in the meantime, hopefully we'll see you at the window.